Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, blessed souls, all people must be singing and dancing. This is part of the prophecies of ancient peoples. And I am so happy and proud and blessed to announce that we're alive because we're staying alive in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim. You're now tuned into the blogtalkradio.com, and we humbly suggest we're the higher inner frequency of Blog Talk Radio. We call ourselves Soul Class. This is Soul Class 593. In discussion with Turtle Island Mohawk native John Kane. Baruch Hashem, bless us our Creator, Shalom, peace, and Baruch, a blessing upon the human family experience with Creator's help. We're now broadcasting live at 10:03 a.m., live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA Unified Soul Actualization. Our program content will be in discussion with, as I mentioned just now, John Kane, an indigenous Native American Mohawk elder, wise man, activist, radio talk show host, and all-around righteous soul who will educate us about whom some would call Indians have endured since encountering the insidious doctrine of discovery generated by a 15th century pope, being stigmatized by being belittled by mascotting, which has permeated public symbolism ranging from junior high schools until professional sports organizations. And last but not least, the Native American indigenous peoples have not lost their sensitivity towards this blessed creation while being treated so poorly by Western Edomite civilization. We are promoting all human beings should work in harmony with the earth, not destroyed for the sake of some sort of distorted, euphoric, strange worship of physicality, instead of revering the gift of life bestowed upon us by a merciful creator. And I now want to bring in my co-host for today, John Kane. It's a genuine pleasure to have you on today, sir.
Well, thanks, Don, for having me. It's a pleasure to join you.
John, I'd like to, you know, we have a term in Hebrew called Hakar Satov, you know, being acknowledging for the goodness. And one of the reasons why I'm connecting to you is through a third person who is not connecting with us today on the live broadcast, but I want to read his wisdom, and I think this, you embellish this point, you exemplify the point that Theogosin Gorstos wrote on Facebook. Of course, you can embellish what you want from what I'm going to say, and I, as a Jew, also would hope one day to fully actualize what T. Teokasin is emanating through this wisdom here. And it goes like this. This one native person doesn't speak for all native peoples. This one native person doesn't speak for all indigenous peoples. This one native person brings to you the voices of other indigenous peoples and lets you hear them, lets you actually listen to them, and tries not to be bigger than the message. The message is truth, nothing else. We must not become bigger than the message. We must not become bigger than the truth. By Teokasin goes to us, and thank you, Teokasin. Because of you, I'm now speaking with John Kane. John, anything you'd like to extract that from Teokasin's wisdom?
Well, I think that is one of the issues that we see all the time. We lift up individuals and we give them this iconic status. So when they speak, we give the impression that they are speaking for everyone. And mm-hmm. So this isn't just something that we relegate to an individual, but there are some individuals who take that upon themselves. So every time they speak as if they're representing a large class of people, for instance, or a large group of people. One of the things that Teokasin and myself often will not just suggest, but will flat out say is, look, we don't speak for anybody else. When I speak and I express the views that I express on my show or in my writing, I make it very clear that I'm not offering the native perspective. I'm offering a native perspective, and the reason I'm offering that perspective, and I'll be honest with you, sometimes the views that I express are not the ones that are widely held, even amongst native people. But I mm-hmm. offer it because it is something that I have developed out of my investigation on a certain subject, or as I dissect certain things. And so I offer that perspective not to necessarily convince everybody else of my view, but to say, look, there are other views out there. And I think when we talk about diversity, it's nice to talk about diversity if we're only talking about the color of skin, perhaps. But if we're not going to understand real diversity in terms of diversity in thought and understand that every, creation has given every one of us a set of eyes. Creation has given every one of us a set of ears and the ability to feel. Both on the on our skin and feel emotionally. So if we don't understand that with every one of those individual abilities to receive information, that we're not going to have a broad sense of how that information is interpreted. And I think if we think that the only interpretation of data or of observation can be attributed to one or two individuals. And of course, this gets into theological issues as well. If we don't understand that even whether we look at religions or how we're interpreting those religions, if we say it is only this way, then I think sometimes we can confuse the issue. And I think it's really important that people understand that by understanding the diversity of thought is when real, true, and genuine conversation can take place.
John, I couldn't agree with you more, and this is something that is in our people's tradition of the nation of Israel. And, John, before we begin to talk about the doctrine of discovery, bless us all, I want you to know out there that there was a tremendous damage done within the human family experience in the last 2,000 years where a group of people formulated a system of dominating Europe. And one of the means by which it was done through an entity which is still active today, known as the Vatican. Now, we, the Jewish people, were used as target practice basically from the beginnings of the church, and it didn't just affect us Jewish people. And then the Europeans, under the aegis of their religiosity, came into the West. Now, I was unaware, I just know from our own people's history, with the Inquisition of 1492, and then later I learned only in the last couple of months that the Inquisition has basically went well into the 19th century. I just thought it was into the 15th century, early 16th century. But the American Native Indigenous peoples of what we call Turtle Island, also I'll ask John to explain this, what Turtle Island, why we're calling America, the United States of America, this continent, Turtle Island, that the up until this day, the indigenous peoples of Turtle Island are still terrorized, infected, and hurt emotionally, physically, economically, and their lives were taken in great numbers in the last 400 plus years. So, John, I basically set up sort of like the hashtags, the tags for the subject matter. Can you please take the ball and run with it?
Okay. Well, one thing I got to be a little bit clear on, there's always going to be some debate on where oppression comes from. whether, you know, for instance, if we look at what the Native experience has been at the hands of the United States, fraudulent treaties, the land grabs and all the other stuff, is, you know, the question can be raised, is that being done by the U.S. government, initiated by the U.S. government, or is it being initiated by individual interests that use mm-hmm. the U.S. government as a tool? So mm-hmm. I say that because even these papal bulls that lie at the foundation of the doctrine of Christian discovery, granted, these papal bulls came from the Vatican, and they didn't even they started back with Western Africa. In the 1452 and 1455. So this is before we're even talking about Turtle Island, our home, North America. But you have to understand that there ends up being this play between church and state. Is the church directing the state, or is the state looking at the church for cover? And I'm not sure which is which, but when these mm-hmm. papal bulls come out, and especially after Columbus's voyage to the Caribbean, and these papal bulls come out, which essentially entitle European and of course what was actually described as the Christian nations of Europe to go into any land held by pagans and claim it, and basically regard the land as uninhabited. They have an expression called terra nullius, which basically means that it was void of humanity. So the fact that mm-hmm. that we lived, that the African population was living in Africa, or the Native population was living in on Turtle Island, that we could be regarded as subhuman. That's what. So when you have that coming out of the church, that it's clear that it did. The question is it driven by the church, or is it driven by the greed of the countries that were utilizing those church doctrines? And I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. It's like there's enough guilt on this thing to spread around, because a mere papal bull. There have been papal bulls that have not had the global effect that the ones regarding the doctrine of discovery would have. But as you rightly pointed out, this isn't just something that comes from the 15th century. This is something that right. that not only just dominates the Western Hemisphere and causes the death of hundreds of millions of people. And that's the other thing. We oftentimes hear history try to suggest that that our populations in the Western Hemisphere, North and South America, were but a paltry few. But more and more, as archaeologists and anthropologists study it, they every day they keep upping that not only that figure, but moving back the dates in which they can see evidence of what the European societies would call civilization. They keep moving that date back. So mm-hmm. when you consider that this not only starts in the 15th century, but it is something that is not just practiced by Spain, it's and the Dutch and the French and the British and frankly everybody throughout Europe, and even the Russians were involved in some of this, and I think people trying to discount who was involved. Now, and I'm not suggesting that other cultures weren't doing similar things, but this is very clearly defined. It's defined by the Catholic Church in terms of this these papal bulls, the one Inter Cetera specifically from 1493, which essentially lays that out, that a Christian nation can vanquish, can claim the lands and the people themselves, the freedom of the people. They can subject the people to perpetual servitude, and that sounds bad enough coming from the church. But then when you see how the nations of Europe, and even Great Britain, who is not necessarily operating, through much of this under the dominance of the Catholic Church, they understand that this is something that they can use in the other Christian denominations too. So when they send Cabot out to do his voyages and the like, you have Great Britain doing the same thing that the Catholic nations are doing in Europe as well. So, and then of course you fast forward, you get into the establishment of colonies that start to become less tied to their European parents, essentially, and even the United States after it breaks declares its independence from Great Britain. The United States not only embraces this, but they actually embellish it a little bit more, and then they codify it into law. In 1823, the Justice John Marshall Court, the Supreme Court of the United States, under Chief Justice John Marshall, he brings this into federal law, but in a ruling that had nothing to do with Native people, really, other than there was two non-Native people arguing about land title. And one of the parties claims that they had purchased or acquired the land through the Cherokee. And in this case, it's called Johnson v. McIntosh. This codifies the doctrine of discovery into U.S. law. And it is laid at the foundation not only of Native relations with the United States, but it lays at the foundation even of land title law within the United States.
Mm-hmm. And, John, I know on your radio program there was – and by the way, I want to mention everyone still listening to the program today. There's a wonderful DVD that I myself am holding in my left hand as I'm speaking with John. It's called The Doctrine of Discovery, Unmasking the Domination Code, A Story of Historical Truth, Spirituality, and Resistance Told on Behalf of the Original Nations of the People's Great Turtle Island and Elsewhere on Mother Earth. We are still here and still rightfully free. Directed by Sheldon P. Rothschild, co-produced by Stephen T. Newcomb, narration by Buffy St. Marie. John, this
let me correct you. It's Wolfchild, not Rothschild.
I'm sorry. No, I don't think Rothschild would direct this one.
No, I don't think so either, but I wanted to make clear that you understood that.
Okay.
That the director was Sheldon Wolfchild, yeah.
Now, John, there was a painful law decision actually rendered by a Jewish woman, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I'd like you to respond to that, and I want to counter-respond. Can you please clue in our blessed soul audience about this decision made, I think, around 2005, how the Doctrine of Discovery is still being implemented in U.S. Supreme Court law decisions?
Well, as I said, first off, there's no question that the Doctrine of Discovery lies at the foundation of what people call federal Indian law. There's no question about that. And it lies at the foundation of every jurisdictional issue, every land claims issue. And to kind of affirm that is the Oneidas in central New York were reclaiming, they were reacquiring, I should say, purchasing land within their ancestral homeland. They were there was a previous Supreme Court ruling that sided with the Oneidas to say that they had a lawful right to claim title to some of this land. And as a strategy, they began purchasing some of that land and then claiming it as their territory. And of course, in doing so, taking land off the tax rolls and stuff like that. So this you had this little village called the City of Sherrill that was trying to take the land back. They said, "Look, you're not paying taxes. We're gonna reclaim the land." So this case, the City of Sherrill versus the United Indian Nation of New York, makes it all the way to the Supreme Court, and the court rules against the Oneidas. And of course, anytime the court does this, somebody's going to write the opinion on this thing. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who, you know, and again, it has to be stated, is a woman. She is considered one of the more liberal justices on the court, and she has Jewish ancestry. Mm-hmm. So when we read the opinion written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that not only in footnote number one cites the Doctrine of Discovery, I mean, it cites it specifically, and then she gives a general interpretation of that doctrine, which basically says that the land became vested in the discoverers, It doesn't say how it happens. How the title of land transfers from the original inhabitants to. She just says that this is again what the Doctrine of Discovery says, and she cites it as footnote number one. She also cites other legal principles within the United States. One called the Doctrine of Latches, and another one called the Doctrine of Impossibility. Which who knew that was even a legal principle? And all of these things are based on either the inconvenience of Native people reclaiming land that was unlawfully taken, or the amount of time that has the duration of time that has elapsed since that land had been unlawfully taken. It never challenges whether the legality or the equity of the situation. It just uses these principles like this, the Doctrine of Discovery, or these other legal principles to say this is why we're not going to change the status quo. But the hardest part for us is to understand that somebody who is of Jewish ancestry, who understands ancient land claims issues and should have a clearer view, or at least a different view than a typical American, you would think that they would have a sensitivity to that. And in spite of that, she actually cites specifically, and this is 2005. So when I say that this becomes codified in law, and has this effect that is quite contemporary. There are cases even more recent than that, but this one was so blatant because again you have we oftentimes hear this debate, especially through Native territories, about how poorly served we would be by a Republican governor because of their Supreme Court nominees. And I look at Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is considered a liberal justice, taking not only ruling this way, but actually being so bold as to write the opinion this way. It's significant.
I just want to publicly express my pain, John. I mean, in our culture, I know that, I think in the 1960s, there was a convening of the Vatican Council where they wanted to expunge the guilt off the Jews for the quote-unquote killing of their Messiah, which actually we didn't. That was done by the Romans. And I had a thought today before the show that, one Jew was put up on a cross, but the truth is the famous historian Josephus Flavius wrote that over 1,400 Jews were hung up on a cross, crucified in that manner. So I would say if a Jew were to keep one cross in the house, they would keep actually 1,400. Now, with that being said, Ruth Bader Ginsburg does not speak for the nation of Israel. She, unfortunately, in her understanding, I would say misunderstanding of federal law, or just, she is someone who is so much for women's rights, but yet I don't understand how a woman who stands for the rights of women can also not have the sensitivity towards the legal entitlements that the Native peoples, and I understand there are, please correct me if there's over 180 treaties that were negotiated, I guess, in the 18th or 19th century with the Native peoples, of which probably all of them, if maybe were broken. So it pains me that when a Jewish person is so distanced from the teachings and traditions of our people, because I promise you that any Jew who understands what the universal codes are in terms of, first of all, the whole idea, for instance, of just conquering in the name of one's faith amongst the nations is something like, for instance, if Pakistan wants to conquer India because they don't like India's Hinduism, according to the universal codes that we have received from our prophet Moses, that's totally forbidden. Yet peoples don't want to hear about it, and it trickles down in an innocuous fashion until you have this, unfortunately, very wrongful decision which empowers future wrongful decisions, God forbid, against the indigenous people. So I just want to chime on that. I would like to say I can apologize for it, but she'll have to make her own apologies to the Native peoples.
Well, and again, I don't think any of us interpreted her view on this as the view of the nation of Israel or Jewish people as a whole. The part that we find disturbing is that we would assume or like to assume that people who have been persecuted would understand the notion of persecution. And that's,
yes,
I
agree with you.
And that is what I find particularly disturbing in this. But, there's also, I actually had somebody suggest to me that, when a court uses such a weak legal principle, when a court uses a principle that is so clearly rejected by the rest of the world, that it opens up the validity of that court system. And so there's a certain part of me, even when I saw that ruling, although it was certainly not a good ruling for the Oneidas, what it, mm-hmm. to me, what it did is it struck it basically pierces the U.S. court systems in terms of how they deal. Because when we talk about things like international tribunals and stuff like this, we oftentimes think that, you know, the United States can never be held accountable for their actions, and that's kind of the perception of things. But when you see a ruling like this, and again, here's the reality: she just stated what U.S. law is founded on. So the third part of me says, you know, she was bold enough to put it right out there and not hide it. So I'm not saying this to praise her. But what I'm saying is the fact that she was bold enough to make that assertion based on what is normally it's implied and it's referenced to, but the idea that she would put it out there so boldly, to me, makes it easier for me to point to it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, John, for that. John, I'd like to talk now about the next section about mascotting, how this is also what seems to be very innocuous to call a team like the Cleveland Indians. And I mentioned about junior high schools. I grew up in Paramus, New Jersey, during my formative years. And the name of our team at the high school level, we were called the Westbrook Warriors with a picture of a warrior. And I'll be honest with you, growing up in middle-class America, I never gave it a second thought that this could be to the extent that if say a Native American person, indigenous person, would see this emblem of my junior high school team, that they would be insulted. But it really is much more than that, because then you have pictures of the Cleveland Indian baseball team, I think the Atlanta Brave baseball team, and probably the worst case, because of the callousness of the owner of the Washington Redskins, Daniel Snyder, the Washington Redskins. John, can you please educate our listening audience? You know, I never understood, I'll be honest with you, why indigenous people called Redskins, because your skin doesn't look that red. Can you explain the origin of the name Redskins and the psychological damage it does for Native indigenous peoples when they see mascotting or, you know, gross portrayals of what they look like as human beings through cartoon pictures or even movie stigmatizations?
Well, you know, first off, the reality is we're still here. So when you take something like a mascot and you essentially use an image or some sort of whether it's a word or image or any kind of likeness to suggest this is what a Native person is. So whether you're going to define somebody with a name like Indians or warriors or savages or Red Raiders or Redskins, what you're doing is you're putting it in the media, you're putting it in the public consciousness that this is what a Native person is. Mm-hmm. And so it defines us by those images. It's the typical use of stereotypes that is the problem. And of course, when you always say, okay, we use a Native image because of the fierceness or with warriors, you are suggesting we are a violent people. I mean, and so that's part of the problem. I mean, we still exist. We're still here. And much of our culture has nothing to do with war and violence. I'm Haudenosaunee. I'm Mohawk, which is one of the six nations, the original five nations of the Iroquois Confederacy, which we call the Haudenosaunee. Our whole existence was based on the foundation of peace, the elimination of war. It was not based on this warrior culture that people like to perpetuate, and even as the United States or the colonists were declaring and fighting for their independence from Great Britain, we went at length to try to stay out of that conflict, but we got pulled into it, and we were oftentimes victims of the violence between between brothers in that situation. And of course, we were pulled into that conflict, but it wasn't our conflict. And so I think that's part of the damage of stereotypes in general. Now, specifically, and I want to circle back around, but let me address the Redskin issue specifically. Now, there's a lot of debate about the etymology of that word, and I've had some people suggest that it simply had to do with war paint, which is kind of absurd. Uh-huh. There's no question that we have a darker skin color than Europeans did, and you know, so whether that was being interpreted as a redskin or just a darker skin people, you know, that's a little hard to say. But what I will say, the Mohawk word, for instance, and not just the Mohawk word, but many of the indigenous languages, our word for red comes from the same word as blood, because blood to us was the most representative of that color. So when people suggest, oh, well, Native people call themselves redskins, no, that would be tantamount to us calling ourselves bloodskins. Now, having said that, there's no question that both almost all of the European nations, but certainly Great Britain, as they were establishing the colonies here, and of course the United States themselves as the offspring of Great Britain, they offered bounties for scalps, and they would also oftentimes use the word redskin in those proclamations as a part of that proclamation, and they actually would discern the price that would be paid for a bloody scalp, a red skin from a child versus a woman versus a grown man. So these were bounties as if we were animals that they but unlike this was more like a bounty, not because the like a beaver pelt had value. This was to devalue the life of a human being, not because of the value of our scalp, obviously. But this is something that even beyond the bounties, when you talk about the massacres that took place throughout American history, you will see time and time again the reference to our skin, the breasts of women being sliced, you know, cut off and used for pouches, along with the genitalia from men and boys. This is the kind of stuff. So when we hear the word redskin, we associate it with again with these bloody scalps and with the maiming of our people. So, and at very least, it is what is undeniable about words like redskin and red raiders or red men is that it is specifically a reference to either skin color or a person by color, which would be which would not be tolerated by anybody else. I mean, obviously, you wouldn't see those same kind of references made to an Asian, you know, or to an African, or to anybody else. I mean, it is unique to us. But here's the thing that I also want to say, you know, and it wasn't just junior high, by the way. These are elementary schools too, so this goes right down to the grade school level. But the interesting thing about the era in which these Native mascots were incorporated into the American education system and then into the American development of sports, all from college to the pro ranks. In the era, so every time somebody says, well, we've been the red men, or we've been the Redskins for 70 or 80 years, and I've heard some try to date that back even farther. But again, at the same time that the American culture, the white culture of America, was embracing these images and this masquerade of Native culture, our people, our children, were being kidnapped and forcefully taken from their homes and put in residential schools. These residential schools had were a collaboration between the federal government, sometimes the state, and a variety of churches: the Catholic Church, the Methodist Church, the Presbyterian Church. Even the Mormons were involved in these residential schools. And in these schools, our children were beaten. They started by cutting off their hair, ripping, you know, and taking away any clothing or article or anything they would have that would item that they would have that would be associated with their culture. The policy was actually called "Kill the Indian, Save the Man." So the whole idea was to essentially wipe out the Indian nest of children. And of course, if you can take it from the children, then you can have a long-lasting effect. This policy of "Kill the Indian, Save the Man" resulted not just in the abuse of children, not just in killing much of our language and much of our culture, but it broke that bond of parental nurturing between parents and children. It actually severed generations, and it went on for generations. This thing existed for over 100 years. And again, so you've got little children who are being beaten to the point of death. Carlisle Indian School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, has a graveyard. And everybody famously thinks of Carlisle Indian School, and they may know that Jim Thorpe, a Sac and Fox individual, famously becomes the greatest athlete for the United States, and he is essentially developed these skills at Carlisle Indian School, and so that's what people think of Carlisle Indian School. They're naturally associated with Jim Thorpe. They don't associate it with the fact that there was a graveyard there. And I don't know how many people went to a high school or a grade school that had to have a graveyard for those that were perished in that school. But Carlisle Indian School did. It acted all of these residential schools. So our children were beaten to the point of death, and this all had to do with driving out their culture, killing the Indian and trying to save the man. Now, there was physical abuse, there was sexual abuse, there was psychological abuse, and it becomes intergenerational trauma. So at the very time that our children are having the Indian beaten out of them to the point of death, little white kids get to run around and play Indian. They get to put war paint on their faces, and they get to beat a drum and wave around fake tomahawks and do their war whoops. And when I hear people suggest that somehow that is their tradition, that is just it is the most absurd. And again, and I've got to say this for the benefit of your audience, Daniel Snyder is also somebody who has Jewish ancestry, and he is the owner of the Washington Redskins, and he has been the most obnoxious and outspoken opponent to changing the names. Currently, the Washington Redskins basically do not have the patent and trademark protection for that label, because the patent and trademark office has determined that the use of a slur, and again, by all definitions, including dictionary definition, the word redskin is a racial slur, and the patent and trademark office has determined that the U.S. government cannot provide protection for. Now, it doesn't mean they can't use it. It just means that they are not entitled to U.S. protection for a trademark associated with a racial slur. I mean, that's essentially saying the government's going to stand behind behind the use of a derogatory word. Now, the interesting thing is, you think about the Washington football team being this marquee, one of the most profitable marquee sports franchises in the world, and it sits there within the shadows of the U.S. Capitol and the White House. Now, the other thing that should be noted is that there have been UN conventions dating back to the 50s that were geared towards the elimination of all forms of racial discrimination, and yet there sits this marquee football team in the nation's capital, bearing a racial slur.
I just want to, again, respond, Mr. Snyder. I only wish you could hear my voice as a fellow Jew, that you should take down the name of the Redskin. We of the Jewish people, the last 2,000 years since our exile, we've been called all sorts of names. We were made into, they were like Monopoly-type games in Nazi Germany. Everyone's familiar with the prototypical, stereotypical picture of the Jew with the big nose, with the hands behind the back, conniving it. I promise you, John, many of us are not like that, and it just shows that when a person is extracted out of their rootful teachings, our own native teachings, that unfortunately they do as the Romans do, and sometimes they try to be better Romans than the Romans themselves. So with great pain, I acknowledge that this wealthy Jewish person is not giving, in fact, he's creating more anti-Semitism. And I can understand if an indigenous person would look at me at enmity, but hopefully it would be my efforts on an interpersonal basis to help him or her understand that not everyone thinks like a Daniel Snyder. And I think several years ago as well, there was a quote-unquote Jewish Orthodox government official who was convicted on doing something, and he also said some slanderous things about the indigenous people. And we should be the very last people on the face of the earth to speak of such negativities. I mean, when I was playing that video, the music to Redbone's Wovoka, the dancing was similar to the way I dance at weddings within my own culture, in a circle, hand in hand, going back and forth. So there's a universal way of celebrating. There's a universal way of rejoicing and recounting our common ancestries and the differences, the nuances. But to forget where one comes from, unfortunately, leads to not only damaging oneself, but damaging others. So is there still an ongoing effort to try to remove the name Redskin from the team's football promotional item or on their jerseys?
Well, there's always been an effort, and there continues to be an effort. And I'm, mind you, this effort from the Native side dates back several decades. It's been 30 or 40 years since some of the first people were protesting some of these names. But currently, because of that, and Trademark Office has essentially ruled against the Washington football team, the football team is in the process of an appeal. And now this has happened before, and here's another twist of irony, I guess, is when the first time that the Patent and Trademark Office had essentially pulled its protections for that trademark, the football team, the franchise, appealed it, and they appealed it and won. And here's the basis they won it on. They said the Suzanne Harkel, who had brought the case, that they said since she was they said she waited too long, and by that what they meant was that if she was injured by this, once she turned 18 years old, she was then an adult who could bring a case. And when she brought that case, and she was, you know, significantly older than 18, put it that way. And and so they said that in order for this case to withstand that kind of statute scrutiny, that it would have to be somebody who does it within a certain time frame of being eligible to bring the case. So the Washington football team had that decision overturned on appeal. So a group of younger people, you know, people who were within 7 years of their 18th birthday, brought the same suit back. And that's what Amanda Blackhorse is one of the people who's on that case as one of the petitioners. And so the idea that that somebody had basically squandered that 7 year period since their eligibility to bring a case was no longer at play. It is still being appealed. It's kind of crazy, and I've heard some of the arguments that the Washington football team is making on this thing. But here's my thoughts on this. The moment this thing actually goes through the appeal process at the Patent and Trademark Office, then my thought is that the NFL themselves will no longer be able to support a trademark and logo that can't be protected by trademark, because this really comes down to money, you know, for many of the it's not so much for the high school, but for the pro teams, there are some people say that brand, that Washington football brand, is worth millions, if not billions of dollars, and to change it will cost money. Now, to say that there isn't opportunity to make money because everybody's going to have to buy, you know, all the new merchandise that would be available. There's tremendous opportunity there. But I believe that if when this thing goes through the appeal process with the Patent and Trademark Office and the court systems, because this is even being appealed in court, not just in the Trademark Office itself, that when the petition goes through the courts, if this loss of trademark protection stands, then I think that the Daniel Snyder will be forced to change it. Now, having said that, I'm not necessarily a fan of these things having to be forced by litigation or by lawsuit. I just think that the public should be more aware of this, and they should not be so willing to dismiss the damage that gets done. We have the highest suicide rates. We have the highest dropout rates. We top every list that people do not want to top, and you can't suggest that the continuing of stereotyping of our people. And, you know, and then I'll give you another example going back to high school issues. We have a high school here not far from where I live that calls themselves the Warriors. And in that school, there are Native kids that go there. And ironically, the kids who have the highest expulsion rate, the highest dropout rate, and the lowest, you know, achievement levels in high school are the Native kids in that school. And why are they, you know, what is the main problem? The problem has to do with discipline and the fact that they rebel and the fact that they have a fierceness about them. Almost every quality you associate with a warrior, these kids demonstrate in their daily lives, and yet they are punished for it. So the idea that you are going to perpetuate this stereotypic image of this fierce, rebellious, unconstrained Native individual as a logo, and yet you're going to condemn the kids who demonstrate any aspect of that. And that's where I say it is damaging. It's damaging today. It's damaging for the future. And again, when I've literally taken a position with a local high school here in the Buffalo area called Lancaster, and I listen to this is a community that is 98% white, and I listen to these people say, no, we're Redskins. In fact, they actually tried to deny. They said, you guys aren't Redskins. We're Redskins. Now, I don't have a problem somebody telling me that I'm not a Redskin, but the idea that they want to embrace that identity to the point that they claim it for themselves and that they claim the imagery, it really is preposterous. But, no, this is an ongoing fight. There are two school systems in the state of New York that not only have a Native reference but still bear the name Redskin. That's Oriskany out near Utica, and Kenesteel Greenwood down near Hornell on the southern tier of kind of central New York, or the southern tier of New York. So there's still two high schools in the state of New York that still bear that name.
John, I don't know if I'm sure you're aware, but I want to share with this week because I think a lot of people are still not aware of this. This past Thursday, something controversial came up there's a host of one of ESPN shows called Highly Questionable. His name is Bomani Jones. And he's known to incite debates on social media with his opinions. So on his day off, he swung by ESPN's Mike and Mike. I don't really listen to that. Sporting a dark blue shirt with the word Caucasian in seminal font, and color scheme is that of the Cleveland Indians jersey and merchandise. The team has had come under fire for still using the Chief Wahoo logo, a depiction of a red-faced Native American, while which the franchise says it's phasing out as mascot. Jones' shirt had a wide smiling white mare with a dollar sign where the feather would be on Chief Wahoo. And ESPN freaked out over Jones' shirt and asked him to cover it up. What's your take on this, John? Is Bomani doing something to widen the dialogue, or is he just calling attention upon himself? What's your take on this?
No, I think that he made a valid argument. He said, look, if anybody's offended by that shirt, And I'm very familiar with the story. And of course, this shirt has been around for a while. And again, it's an absolute knockoff or satirical image, to take off on the Cleveland Indians logo and using the same font and everything else to say Caucasian. But Jones was making a point. He said, if you're offended by this shirt, then you should absolutely understand what's offensive about the Cleveland Indians logo and again the use of Native masketry in general. And you know, so yeah, he wore the shirt to make a statement, but I don't think he's trying to draw attention to himself. He's spoken out on this issue before, and the idea that ESPN, rather than just kind of letting it flow, was actually had taken the position that to suggest that he covered up, and which he did not completely comply. He covered it up. He closed his outer shirt a little bit, but no, he refused to do it, and I praise him for it because this is the kind of attention that we need. I mean, a few years back there was a the owner of a basketball team, was it Donald Sterling? Yeah, I think Donald Sterling of the
the California
Los Angeles.
Team.
Yeah. He made some. He was recorded in making these absolute racist comments, and it actually got to the point where basketball players had boycotted and were actually going to refuse to play. So that kind of response that comes from the sports community, from the actual participants, had a huge effect. The problem with most of us as we address this mascot issue is that most people are noticeably silent, notably silent. I mean, even the president of the United States. You know, and when he weighed in on it, and I had a whole lot of people say, "Oh, isn't it great that President Obama weighed in on this?" But let me be clear what he said in his statement. And I'm going to paraphrase, but he said, "If I had a team, and that team, the name of that team offended a significant number of people, I would seriously consider changing the name." So he said, "If I had a team, and that team had a name that offended a significant number of people." And I would think about it. So, I mean, there's a lot of ifs in that statement. And he also suggested that it had to offend a significant number of people, which is kind of not – then it becomes a numbers game. And because right now, if you look at – certainly you look at the native population, we aren't a significant number. In the overall scheme of things, we represent less than 1% of the population of the United States. So we will never be a significant number in the overall scheme of things. And 80% of the American public in the last poll not only weren't offended by a name like the Washington Redskins, they thought it was they liked the name. So if it becomes a numbers game, and instead of a real equitable and socially conscious issue. No, then it really is an uphill battle. Because if it's only going to be about whether the majority thinks something is wrong or right, we would never progress as a culture. I mean, certainly the United States has battled things like slavery and civil rights and women's rights and all kinds of religious freedom issues. This is an ongoing battle because you have a dominant culture and a dominant voice, which is the kind of that white privilege that allows these things to continue. So when I see somebody like Jones wearing a shirt like this, many of us were very, very impressed that he was able to, or that he was not only able but willing to take this stance. And I'd love to see more people in the media. There are certain media outlets that won't use the word. They won't say the R word. They'll refer to the Washington football team. They won't use the name. This is an ongoing debate. But I'll tell you, ultimately, I think that enough noise and enough pressure will be made, and I think the Washington football team will change its name. And I think the use of native mascots and mascotry in sports and at the school, the grade school, high school level, at the college level, it's pretty much been eradicated at the college level. I mean, only the Florida State Seminoles continue to use a native image, and of course, it's a false image. They literally have what they call Chief Osceola riding out on a horse in a field and throwing a spear. The Seminoles lived in a swamp. Wasn't a whole lot of horseback riding through the Everglades. So, I mean, the image is preposterous. And of course, what we'll hear is that the reason that the Florida State still uses the name is because they made some sort of arrangement or deal with the Seminoles of Florida for the use of that name. The problem with that is most of the Seminoles don't live in Florida. The Trails of Tears and the removal policies of the United States, most Seminoles live in Oklahoma, and they do oppose the name. And in fact, every Native organization across the country has opposed these names, and it is only the Seminoles of Florida because of and I don't know if it's a pay to play deal or if it has to do with scholarships or whatever that continues, but. But, even this isn't just something that affects the Seminoles of Florida all by themselves. So I see the winds of change are still blowing on this thing.
Okay. I just like to respond, John, that say you have a New York basketball team called the New York Knicks. If somehow the owners were to change them to the New York Kikes, I guarantee you the Jewish population would be in uproar. So I hope that the continual activism and social awareness will continue to swell, because, again, it just boggles my mind as a resident of this country for the past almost 54 years that on the one hand there's a sensitivity for certain issues and just cold, outright apathy towards the God-given rights of anyone to live here, especially the indigenous peoples. Two quick questions, John. The numbers of indigenous people that lived here in, say, North America or Canada and South America, what numbers are you aware of that at one point before the Europeans came? What was the apex? What was the top number that has been generated or considered in discussions about this matter?
Right now, if you and again, there's a diverging school of thought on this thing, but what used to be considered 20 million people, that number has been exploded by further study in anthropology and archaeology, and the estimates now have the numbers in the Western Hemisphere being over 100 million people in North and South America. By some estimates, 200 million people, and 95% of that population was eliminated. It was eliminated, and not just by the mishaps of biological effects because of disease that were spread incidentally or accidentally. These are deaths by massacre. These are deaths by intentional spread of disease, including Lord Jeffrey Amherst, who is essentially responsible for what is considered the first documented advocacy for the spreading of a disease to wipe out use of germ warfare. He actually suggested that the distribution of infected blankets to the Indians would be an effective way to pave the way for essentially for utilizing the land. Now, the other thing that is rarely ever talked about is also the effects of the rape culture that came with the early settlers and the colonists. I mean, when you think about the conquistadors heading into South America, they were all men, and the rape culture and the spread of venereal disease and the amount of people who perished, by the intent, again, by this aggressive crime against humanity, by the rape that took place between and this was this happened with the Columbus voyages. There's documentation in the journals from Columbus's men about the rape culture. Christopher Columbus himself brought young girls back to Europe for sex as sex slaves. When we talk about the death of indigenous people, it's a nice convenient thing to say, well, they just didn't have the immunity to the diseases that Europeans brought. Well, it wasn't just that the winds carried these diseases. These diseases were carried through rape, and they were carried through trade, through fraud, and through deception as well.
These are matters which are so. For anyone listening in, I know it's painful, but these are messages. This is information that must be shared. We really have to, because, John, I'm in social services, and America has become so dysfunctional. Every year or every couple of years, I hear from psychiatrists in the field that I'm in, more and more people become mentally unbalanced. And I think part of that mental imbalance is the fact that there's a disconnect from the creation. And despite the fact that the indigenous peoples, I'll be honest with you, I feel a little funny even saying Native American, because just the people that were here, the nations that were here before the European came, were so in touch. And I remember a commercial from the early 1970s. Maybe you remember as well. It was an Indian elder riding on a horse, and I think coming up to a seashore, and there was like pollution on the land. He went, and you see a tear running down his eye, and it was like by the Ad Council or whatever, but. It just, there was a time, there was Earth Day and there's sensitivity to the environment. But from my tradition, every nation, every peoples have the unique wisdom. And I think that as we move towards, so I do believe in my simple faith, that we are moving towards universal redemption, that the innate wisdom of the Native American people, the Native indigenous peoples of Turtle Island, and I also would like you to define, before I get to my question, what Turtle Island means, that there is something that the indigenous people of North, South, and Central America can offer that can help rectify this land as a preparation for that time where, as a song in Wovatka, Wovaka from Redbone, is that people will be singing and dancing at this time when the good times come in. So explain to us the psyche of the indigenous peoples, why we must live within the cycle of nature, which we of the Jewish people say is created by the Creator. We don't say nature created itself. Why is it that people are not willing to absorb the natural wisdom that the native peoples here had? And I just want to mention as well, I define the civilization as that which promotes family values and preservation of peoples. And in that way, I think that there's been such an injustice done to the indigenous peoples here, because despite all the oppression that you've experienced the last 400 plus years, you've maintained yourselves and you've maintained your values. Can you comment on these issues? And again, why the term Turtle Island? Where did that term come from?
All right, I'll start with Turtle Island. You covered a lot of stuff there. I gotta.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But I know you can handle it.
Sure. Turtle Island. The bottom line is, and this again goes back to how aware and how vast our population, how vast our trade networks were prior to European contact. And I say that because we understood the shape of the landmass. And frankly, our people evaluated the shape of North America specifically. And that's why Turtle Island, although we oftentimes will spread that reference to meaning the entire North and South America, we looked at the North American continent as a continent that roughly shaped out the shape of a turtle. And so it really is that simple. I mean, our people were aware enough about the coastlines and the shape, everything from the Baja Peninsula to the Florida Peninsula. We understood the basic shape of the continent. So Turtle Island is something that became universal and universally accepted long before before the first European contact. So it really is that simple, that we understood the shape of the continent. And for us, the way we viewed that shape, that it of course, we always made these natural metaphors from nature and from creation to describe everything from the earth being our mother to the moon being our grandmother. These are all references we made that are reverent, and we use these references of reverence to much of creation. Look, a couple of things I want to back up to. You mentioned that one of the most successful PSAs of all times is the Iron Eyes Cody commercials that ran, and they ran. I was a child when those things were first running. Mm-hmm. It actually showed him along the Mohawk River and the pollution. Mm-hmm. It had people littering. But here's the irony of all that. Iron Eyes Cody was not native. He was Sicilian. He was a guy who had success. Yeah, he was not a native person. He was a guy who had success in the movie industry. And the irony of it all is that just like patriots dressing up as Indians to throw tea in the harbor in Boston, even when nobody could see fit to use a legitimate native person even to play that role for the Ad Council's PSA on pollution and litter. So, yeah, Iron Eyes Cody is definitely he definitely is not native. He was Italian. So, particularly more ironic because of when you think about Columbus's genealogy as well.
Wow.
I know that. There's no question that the image had a lot of impact. But again, the thing is, we end up having this whole thing about having a snapshot of who a native person is, and in many ways, Iron Eyes Cody was a guy who took advantage, and that wasn't his real name. I don't remember what his real name is at this point, but that became his stage name and the name that he would he would live by. But, you know, we end up having our images and our philosophy stamped into a snapshot of who we were, and as if we don't exist anymore. There are plenty of us who don't walk around with beads, feathers, and ribbon shirts on a daily basis. I'm one of those people. I'm not going to dress and have my appearance created to suit somebody's vision of what I should look like. I speak on Native issues because, to me, that's what needs to be communicated, not how somebody's going to look at me. So having said that, now when you talk about this notion of again, the problems that exist societally, I agree with you that the part of it is a strong part of it is our detachment from creation and our relationship. Mm-hmm. We have a thing called the Ohundo Guriwadekwa. It's called the words we say before all else. It's like some people call it a prayer, and it's not really a prayer. It's an opening address. Anytime we come together, we list. You know, first we welcome and acknowledge the people who have gathered. And then we go through from the ground, from our mother, the earth, all the way up to the stars and what we call our distant relatives. And we thank and acknowledge, and we draw some reference to the goodness that comes from everything, from the ground to the waters to the plants to the birds to the stars, everything. And we talk about that. And then we also acknowledge the teachers and the enlightened ones who continue to lead us to knowledge. And again, I think there's oftentimes a disconnect between belief and knowledge. For me, a teacher is not a teacher who teaches knowledge, but a teacher is somebody who paves the way for an individual to receive knowledge, because knowledge comes from experience. Even understanding religious doctrine and theological studies, if you spend your life learning these things in, again, from studies and from speakers and from reading and that kind of stuff, until you experience some of those things you've read and were spoken to about, then it's still based on what you're being told, not what you're experiencing. Experience is where knowledge comes from. So that's one of the things that we do. On a regular basis, we acknowledge all of creation. But I also would say that the problem isn't just the disconnect between people and creation. The problem is the disconnect between people. When you think about the suicide rates and depression, we have separated ourselves from each other. We don't have that sense of community. And as you know, it's one of the things that I talk about on my shows all the time, is this lack of community. And that community affects everything from economics to governance to nurturing. I mean, for a few years back, the phrase that became popular. I think it was one of the first ladies that was utilizing this phrase that said it takes a village to. And they said it was an African reference, that it takes a village to raise a child. Well, that's right. I don't know if it's all exclusively an African proverb. This is something that we've been a part of. I would say most indigenous cultures, but certainly our culture. We, even in our marriage ceremonies, we talk about how when a couple becomes a union, that they have a responsibility not just to their children, but to the children that your children interact with, and that we have a responsibility for all of our children. That's what's lost in this thing. So when we separate ourselves from creation, and then we separate ourselves from each other, we have a people that are lost. And again, when you ask what drives this, what drives this this environmental degradation, there's no question that it's driven by greed. There's no question that it's driven by this by consumption and the insatiable appetite to accumulate possessions. That is part of the one of the unique things that that Europeans, when they came amongst our people. In the earliest of some of the earliest writings by Europeans, they said that they marveled at the sense that order could exist without a king, that order could exist without an army, order could exist without these oppressive structures, and they attributed most of that order to the lack of of an overemphasis on possessions. Because although we certainly, you know, had possessions, it wasn't what drove our culture. It wasn't the accumulation of wealth that drove, and that specifically had more to do with the restoration of order and harmony than anything else. Because even with the kings and the queens and the police and the standing army, all of that that chaos still exists. I mean, and I think you can see, you know, the chaos of the world. All of this civilization that this quote unquote civilization that has developed in the last two centuries, what has it got in the world? What it's got in the world is on the brink of climate disaster, constantly on the brink of massive war and violence. It's incredible, and again, almost all of it can be tied at some point to the insatiable appetite for possession and wealth.
John, I couldn't agree with you more. And you mentioned something about gaining knowledge. One of the teachers within the Hasidic movement I'm a part of, in direct descent of King David and Solomon, he said, if a person wants to, as a litmus test for one's understanding of a concept, if one can't bring down even an ivory tower, highly developed intellect into their emotional capacities, and how much more so if they can't implement it into practical action, that even though they might think they might have a grasp on the intellectuality of the concept, even if it's a matter of godliness, but they can't implement some aspect of that godliness that they've learned about and internalized into action, then they're missing, and they could be actually distorting what they think is what they understand.
Oh, I agree with that wholeheartedly. Yeah.
Implementation is the essential, the expression of a human being, of the humaneness of a human being. If you have a good idea, then see how far you can take and implement it to make life better for you, not just for yourself, but your family and for those living around you.
Well, and you know, this is kind of that notion of self-righteousness, right? If you are so consumed with self-righteousness and that you don't apply righteousness to others, then there is no righteousness in self. I mean, it really comes down to something that simple. There, you know, true intellect has to be applicable, and again, so if you don't apply wisdom to allow that wisdom to become experience, because wisdom is going to come from experience. It's not just, I mean, I don't condemn the notion of philosophy, the idea of thinking about things. But the idea of application, you know, and when people think about the fathers of philosophy, they think about, you know, Socrates and Aristotle. These are people who had some very strange and almost racist views when you consider some of the things that. So on one hand, they may have been, and people also, oftentimes they attribute this notion of the humanities as this Greco-Roman Christian European ownership of what is a complete human being. You know, when I get back to this, to that notion of kill the Indian, save the man, you know, we get into this debate about when the word man is used, does it mean save mankind or does it mean to save the individual human? And, you know, and I would argue that that a lot of this stuff has nothing to do with the salvation of a soul, but it has to do with the furtherance of a you know, one specific culture over another. And I think, you know, one of the things, and I want to throw one other thing back to something you mentioned earlier, very early on, about treaties that were broken. I got to tell you that I'm one of those people who believe that there was never a treaty negotiated in good faith. I think that there was never a treaty negotiated by the United States that was ever intended to be followed. And of course, the evidence, my evidence to suggest that, is the fact that they were all broken. If any of them were meant to be a sustaining relationship, I mean, in the Canandaigua Treaty with the Six Nations, I'm not a fan of because it was a huge land grab. The language, the one line that is repeated at least three times, and it's only a 7-article treaty, says that the United States acknowledges that our land is ours, and that they will never claim the same nor disturb us in the free use and enjoyment of that land or of our friends and allies on that land. So it's mentioned three times. This is 1794. In 1794, the United States, under President George Washington, was acknowledging, they wrote it, we didn't write this, acknowledging that our land was ours, and that they, mm-hmm. the United States would never claim the same. Never is never, right? And yet 40 years later, in Johnson v. McIntosh, the United States would codify into law this notion of doctrine of discovery that would suggest that that we couldn't have title to land, that we were like the animals. We just had the right to live on land. We had no land title. And then the entire land title of the continent would be established through this notion that a European nation, a Christian nation, were the only ones who would claim title. And of course, that would tie into the so-called Louisiana Purchase, where the United States buys this huge swath of land from France. France didn't own it. There were native people living there. Even the acquisition of Alaska from Russia. Russia, how could Russia have owned the land? There were people who lived there. And of course, even when you get into the illegal occupation of Hawaii, I know I kind of threw this thing back, but this all goes back to environmental degradation, because when mm-hmm. this land title is claimed in the way that it is, this is when it opens up the exploitation for gold mining and for uranium mining and for coal mining and for damming up every river and causing so much environmental degradation. And, of course, the massive destruction of forests and not rainforests in South America. But again, how much of the landscape changed because of the quote unquote manifest destiny, the white man's burden as it pushed west across the Turtle Islands landscape.
John, thank you. I am humbled and I am rejoicing in the fact that I've played a molecule role in allowing you to disperse this information to an audience that probably has never heard such well elucidated information. And I just hope in the future I'll be able to, because we've only touched, I think, the tip of the iceberg of all these issues in the past 77 minutes. I hope in the future I'll be able to have another program with you to discuss these issues and go a little bit deeper into it, because when we get into the nuances of all the details, I mean, I know that there's a saying, the devil's in the details. No, in the details we can find out actually what's gone wrong in the creation. And if we learn about these nuances, in particularly against the indigenous peoples of Turtle Island, then hopefully this is going to wake up people. Because again, as I mentioned before, and I'll mention again, I don't understand the sense, and I'm not saying you shouldn't have, we should definitely have sensitive to women's rights and for other people's rights. But, you know, you were the host peoples when, I mean, my personal family tree line came to America in basically the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, because unfortunately the anti-Semitism in Europe. So I'm happy to say that my family has not didn't have any direct connection to things. Although I know there are other Jews that were involved in certain things that were perfidious acts against the native indigenous peoples. But again, they will have to make those rectifications. What I'm trying to do with my little molecule of effort is to bring this dialogue out and as to a diversity of opinions, a true plurality, and it's done in such a peaceful and pleasant manner, sir, that I want to thank you, and I humbly call upon the Creator of all creation to bless you and your efforts and the efforts of Teokos and Ghost Horse. I'd like to leave you with the last word before we sign off. How can other blessed human souls hear you on your radio shows in New York City and upstate New York or your blogs? I'd like people to know how they can contact and listen to more of your wisdom.
Well, of course, myself and Teokos, for that matter, we're both on WBAI in New York City. That's FM 99.5 WBAI in New York City. We're mm-hmm. both on Thursday. He comes on at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I come on at 10. I have a 2-hour show that is also a talkback show. In fact, on I know that you called in on that that program, and I greatly appreciate that.
Thank you.
My show involves me usually bringing on a guest, having a bit of a dialogue for hour one, and then opening up the phone lines for hour two. Incidentally, I will mention that I've got I have Bernie Sanders' wife joining me this coming Thursday at 10 o'clock. Mm-hmm. On my show is called Let's Talk with John Cain. Mm-hmm. And if you tune in to, again, 99.5, You'll get a chance to hear that interview. It is not a taped interview. It is going to be a live conversation. So what you're hearing is not staged. There's no script. I did not hand a list of questions in advance. It's going to be a genuine conversation. I think Mario Murillo is going to join me in that conversation as well. And that's coming up. By the way, you can also listen to it online. If you go to WBAI.org, www.WBAI.org, there's a stream live tab you can press there. So you can certainly listen to it. Even after the fact, you can go to the archive page and just look back to that segment any WBAI program, Teogason's included, can be listened to after the fact, and I encourage people to go to that archive page. Now, I also do a show out in where I live. I live on the Cattaraugus territory of the Seneca Nation, and I do a show that streams live over the Internet and goes into a rotation of shows that replay on a steady stream. But the best way, because it's a long URL to play out over for me to stay over the radio, but the best way to stay in contact and to engage me is on Facebook, frankly. Yeah, if you go on Facebook, not only do I have my own profile page, John Kane, that's K-A-N-E, but I have two group pages. The most dominant group page I have, which has over 6,000 people in the group, is associated with my show here on the Seneca territory. It's called Let's Talk Native. So if you request to join that group, I will approve that request. It is a group page that has a lot of links, a lot of people post. It's an open page. I welcome people to post anything. It's about Native issues. So I jokingly say that anybody can post anything. It doesn't mean it's going to stay there, because I will remove posts that are unproductive to the conversation or exploitive or anything. But that is a place for a dialogue. I also have a page that is associated with my show in New York, and it's called Let's Talk with John Kane on WBAI. So those are two group pages that if you request to join that group, you will be able to engage with me there. Even if you're not a part of the group, you can still pull it up and look at it. And I have all of the links to the shows that are coming up and to the shows in the past. So at any given show, I will promote in advance, and then I'll post the link to the archive or to the audio for that show after the fact. So that is probably the best way is through Facebook. But you know what? You can reach me through the station at WBAI. I'll offer my email address here. It's jmkane1220@aol.com. I'd be grateful to hear people. I do have the ability to travel and to do speaking engagements, and I've done some. I've gotten to speak at some very prestigious events. I've spoken at the university or Arizona State University. Relating to the federal recognition process, one which I am not a fan of. I've also spoken at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., on a program that was called From Doctrine to Declaration, which ties the doctrine of discovery and the dichotomy between that and the Declaration. The UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which is another issue that I talk about quite a bit. So there's a lot to be discussed. Don, I would be happy to join you once again and to further some of the conversations we have here. We can drill it down a little bit more closely on specific issues or have the conversation in any way that you'd like. But I would be happy and grateful to join you again.
Thank you, John. With that being said, blessed souls, we're going to conclude today's program with an artist who I just discovered this morning. His name is, I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, Carlos Nakai or Naki. He is
Carlos Nakai.
Nakai.
Yeah.
You're familiar with him?
He's one of the greatest flute players there is.
Okay. So he's a Navajo Ute. Is that connected with the name Utah?
Utah.
Oh, Ute. Ute.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll talk about that hopefully the next time we get together on the radio. Musician, and this music is music of the fusion of heaven and earth. Remember, blessed souls, I want to remind everyone that for, especially for my my Jewish listening audience and B'nai Noah audience, in order for us to really make the world right, we have to listen to everyone's perspective. And I think it's high time that we hear more and more, and we should be hearing more of the voices of Theokas and Ghost Horse and John Cain and their other great people who can elucidate the needs of the indigenous peoples, that they must be heard. And we have, and people might disagree or agree, but the point is the dialogue. This is in the finest of Jewish tradition. It's called intellectual engagement. It's called emotional attachment. It's called soul connection. And hopefully, may we manifest these connections away. Habachad, one love, Gorlachad, one destiny, for all of us. B'darchinom, darchishom, in a pleasant and peaceful way. Lahamshik b'ezem yisparech. To be continued with the blessing of the Most High. And I have to remind you, blessed souls, and even though it might cause you some anxiety and some ambivalence, you've got to be good. Why do you have to be good? Because it's tov lehiti. It's the nature of the good to do good. The Creator is the source of all goodness. And therefore, since you came from something beyond yourself, something from within the earth and beyond the earth, beyond the heavens, the one who spoke and the world came into being, you have to retain this earth spirit. So we're going to conclude again with Carlos Nakai. Let's retain our spirit with the earth, and the earth will certainly reflect back to us the blessings that we need to make this a wonderful abode for the incomplete human family experience. Take care, everyone.